Hello and welcome to this Future of Real Estate podcast. I'm Damien Wild, Editor-in-Chief of EG. Before we focus on the future, I just want to draw briefly on the past. Cast your mind back to 2009. Differently challenging times. We may not have done referendums back then, but with the consequences of the global financial crisis still playing out, uncertainty was rife. Still, that didn't stop new real estate businesses launching, few perhaps as successfully as M7. In the decade since launch, M7 has grown and grown. It now has more than 200 employees in 13 countries across Europe, managing a multi-billion euro portfolio of retail, office and industrial properties. I'm pleased to be joined today by Richard Croft, who this week becomes executive chairman of the business. Richard, welcome.
Thank you very much.
How is business?
Business is really good. So this is my first day as chairman, having been CEO for the last 10 and a half years, and I'm really enjoying it. I'm able to do things like this and be here and not so tied up with the day-to-day management of the business, which is exciting.
That's the difference, is it? It's to free you up to do more strategic things?
Yeah, no, so that's the plan. So David Eberle, who's become the CEO, has been the CIO for the last 5 years, actually. And he and I have been business partners for 15 years. He's an extraordinarily talented guy. And the time was right for him to take over the day-to-day management of the business with Teresa Gilchrist, who's today become the chief operating officer. Actually, she's not Teresa Gilchrist, she's Teresa Dyer. She got married at the weekend.
So congratulations.
Well, yes. Yeah,
so pass them on.
So Teresa, when you're listening to this, congratulations. It was a great party, by the way. Anyway, so those two are taking over the day-to-day management of the business, and it hopefully will free me up to spend more time concentrating on the growth of the business, concentrating on our key strategic partnerships, and on the strategy of our future funds. So it's, you know, very, very exciting time.
And you launched in challenging times, I said, and I said that these times are differently challenging. The market's not easy at the moment, is it?
No, but very, very different times. So in 2009, when we started the business on April the 14th, 2009. I don't know, maybe we set the tone for the business, but in 2009, we then spent a big chunk of our working capital on our launch party, which was a great party, but it sort of didn't really achieve.
There is a continuing theme here, isn't there?
Well, just bookending those 10 years, there was a bit of work in between. But we started a business with 18 people and no income and no business. And to anybody who listens to this, if you ever get an opportunity to do that, don't. It's really stressful. So it took us about 3 years to sort of get the business going. And we have had an awful lot of luck on the way through. I think most successful businesses have to be in the right place, right time, and have to have a decent strategy. But the sort of thing, the component that I think sets really successful businesses apart is actually just a bit of luck. And we've had a lot of that in various guises. So as the business has grown, I think we have benefited from movements in the market. And if we get to where we are today, I mean, the market is tricky, but for what we do, the zero interest rate policies adopted by pretty much the whole of Europe, and the UK, to all intents and purposes, means that our business continues to attract capital because we are a genuine income-producing phenomenon. If that's the right word, it sounds a bit arrogant. So maybe we'll readjust that word. But we are genuine income-producing investment strategy.
I think if the executive chairman of the business can't say that, then who can?
Yeah, I know. But I mean, when you say things like that and then you hear it back, you think, no, that's probably, you know, phenomenon is a pretty strong word. So I'm going to go with a genuine income-producing investment strategy. That sounds a bit more grown up.
Okay. So let's be a little bit more explicit about the challenges that are out there. And I was looking back at something you told EG last year, actually, and you said, perhaps presciently, a combination of Brexit, Trump, the rise of nationalism and the politics that goes with it, which includes protectionism, is definitely a cause for concern as it pertains to real estate. London is already suffering from a slowdown, in my opinion, from that. And that's what we've seen play out, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think we're going to see more of it. I mean, one of the things that I'm bearish London. In fact, I'm bearish megacities, generally. So for those people listening, saying, well, he's just talking his own book, those people who know me, there's some degree of truth in that. But the reason why we have the book we have is because I'm bearish megacities, and I think there's more opportunity in the regions. But the reason that I'm bearish megacities is affordability is going to be a massive issue. It is already in London. There's an article in the Times today about how San Francisco has become a very complicated place to live because of affordability. But what fascinates me about London is I'm told, everywhere I read, again, people talking their own books, is how well the London office market is doing. And it isn't. But I'm going to get shot down in flames here. But all these big towers that are being built just around your office building are mostly pre-let, and everybody's saying, oh, it's a huge success. You go, okay. But if you strip WeWork out of the last 2 years of lettings, it doesn't look nearly as good as it does with WeWork in. But also the thing to bear in mind is none of these towers are completed. So all the pre-lets that have happened here are going to create vacant space in about 18 months' time. And I ask you, who's going to take that space, that grey space? I think that is going to sort of really show a very different theme to the London market. And they were saying, well, there's not a lot of prime. Well, there's all the space coming back. And because these towers have attracted a lot of really glitzy tenants, it's what they leave behind, I think, is really going to show the true state of the London market. And also, for those people who say, well, Brexit hasn't had an impact on London, I mean, if you take a business like mine, we have a big office, well, big office, 22,000 square feet here. We probably have 130 people in various guises in London. The reality is that if Brexit really does happen, businesses like ours are faced with issues of having to move our regulated entity because we don't think there's going to be equivalence. So our regulated entity will probably have to go to Luxembourg. Our investment management function or our headquarters might have to go to Amsterdam because of the risk of transfer pricing. So lots of people have contingency plans. Nobody wants to move. I mean, we're a British business. And I'm very proud of the success we've had. You know, we're a company that three times has been voted one of the 1,000 companies that inspires Britain. We have generated an awful lot for the revenue here, and we're a hugely successful exporter because almost all of our money comes from Asia, Middle East, little America, other parts of Europe. But I think 95% of our income would be counted as exports. And if we have to move key parts of our business abroad because being in Brexit Britain doesn't allow us to function, that's got to be a concern. And, you know, I know there are lots of other businesses like mine that are putting off the decision because we want to be here, because I'm British. But if we have to go because of the circumstances the government gives us, that's got to be a concern. And, you know, got to be a concern for the London market.
And a hard Brexit would force those aspects of your business abroad?
It depends on what happens to things like equivalence, what happens to things like transfer pricing. But the government isn't giving us a lot of guidance. But if you assume that, so we're FCA rate regulating, we're AFIM. But if we don't get the equivalence, then yeah, we're going to have to move our regulated entity and we will have to move our headquarters, because if transfer pricing would become a big issue, then, you know, we wouldn't take the risk of remaining headquartered in Britain for what is 80% a European Union-based business.
And we've seen the decline in transactions this year, and it seems to be worse and worse. But you're talking about the occupational market yet to be revealed, consequences there.
Well, potentially. I mean, the problem is, I mean, I don't know what a lot of other business leaders are thinking. Actually, it's not true. I do know what a lot of them are thinking. But, you know, everybody is waiting to make a decision. But there are lots of contingency plans in place, and I don't think the government and the pro-Brexit lobby is really paying enough attention to those of us who don't think it's a great idea.
As you said, that is a crack of thunder, that feels.
Yeah, I mean,
it
feels apposite, because these are definitely stormy times, and I'm fairly vocal about the fact that I think Brexit is not a great idea, and I'm fairly vocal that I think a second referendum would probably be a good idea, but only because we can have a definitive outcome in the government if it properly legislated for a second referendum. Because part of the problem we have with this one is, it was so poorly legislated for. It was advisory, first of all, so it actually has no standing in law. The Brexiteers will point out that's a non-point. I'm not sure it is. And I think that if we had a second Brexit referendum that had the appropriate safeguards in place in part, but also the appropriate legislation that allowed the executive, I mean, very simply, allowed the executive to undertake, without House of Parliament interfering, whatever happened, either to revoke or to deliver a WTO Brexit. I mean, I think a WTO Brexit is a lunacy, but if people vote for it again with all of the knowledge that they now have, and even somebody like me would have to put up my hands and go, just fair enough, that is democracy spoken. But, you know, the Vote Leave campaign fundamentally campaigned on a deal Brexit. They did. I mean, Leave.eu didn't, but Vote Leave did. And it is, I'm not sure what the right word is here, but I mean, it is inappropriate for them to say that no, everybody knew what they were voting for. They didn't. This time, if you had on the ballot paper WTO Brexit versus Remain, and everybody was clear about what both things meant, what remaining the EU meant, what WTO Brexit meant, you know, and also I want to be very clear that when people talk about a deregulated economy. That's great for employers. It's not great for employees because it's going to mean less employment rights. And as long as everybody who's voting for it understands that and it's properly explained by both sides, then I'm okay with the outcome. But I just don't think that democracy has been well served by what is effectively an opinion poll that 70% of the electorate voted in. And I mean, here's some stats for you. The thing that I feel strongest about, perhaps, is that my citizenship is going to be changed by Brexit. I'm going to cease to be a citizen in the EU. And I live in Suffolk, as you know. Very proud of my county. I'm a man of Suffolk. I'm a Englishman. I'm a Briton. And I'm a European. And for me, they are not mutually exclusive. And so a group of people wants to take one leg of that away from me. And I'm not that thrilled about it. But if we are going to consent to that, I think it requires more than 17.4 million people, which just, you know, they are 37% of the electorate. It is 25% of the population. And that means that 75% of the population haven't voted for this. Now, you say, well, children, et cetera, don't have the vote, so that's a nonsense number. Yeah, okay, but it's 37% of the electorate. 63% of the electorate haven't voted to have their citizenship changed. And again, I just want people to consider that. You know, Brexit changes the concept of who and what we are of the last 43 years. And the Brexiters might quite rightly point out, and I have sympathy with that, is, well, you know, you've changed my citizenship too, and we get that, but we've got to have, to my mind, a more grown-up debate than we have, and I think a second referendum would allow this, and with the proper legislation put in place by the government, I do think that the outcome, even if it remains the same, becomes much more palatable for the Remainers in terms of where we are now, where I don't feel that even though it is very absolutely fair that Brexit won that vote, it was close enough for there to be a full democratic mandate for something that's going to change the country so fundamentally. Anyway, I'm sorry, I didn't mean this to be an anti-Brexit broadcast. I mean, it's not that I'm anti-Brexit, it's just that what's happening at the moment seems to be not benefiting the country enormously well.
There's plenty of things I want to talk to you about today and bring in our other guests shortly as well. But just on a last point on that point, perhaps, that if there is a hard Brexit on the 31st of October or the 31st of January, whenever and if that plays out and you're forced to take some tough decisions that may result in you moving key aspects of your business overseas, based on conversations that you have with peers in the real estate business, similar investor, developer, asset managers, will others do the same, do you think?
I'm not sure. I mean, I was with one investor yesterday. I'm a man that I, you know, hugely admire. You know, our first backer is a Brexiteer. And the man I had lunch with, who, you know, I'm not going to name anybody, but, you know, who runs a very successful, smaller version of M7, but I mean, hugely successful, is a Brexiteer. I mean, we've tried to talk about why they are. And I think they see opportunity in Brexit. I mean, the pound is going to almost certainly, in a hard Brexit, become a bit cheaper. So if you have access to foreign capital, then you're going to have opportunity. And I think they see it as an opportunity. But they're not pan-European businesses. They are primarily UK-focused. And I think they see an option or an opportunity through disruption capital.
And does it mean that you will switch more of your attention to Europe? Much of your attention is there already, but...
No, I think actually a hard Brexit, I mean, I'm going to use this analogy advisedly, but no, we'd probably spend more time investing. We will certainly invest more money in the UK if there was a hard Brexit. I think there will be opportunity. But most of our money comes from overseas, and if sterling depreciates by a further 10%, by any metric, asset-backed sterling becomes a very attractive investment opportunity. But here's the irony. So people with access to capital are going to be able to clean up assets and make money, which is fine, but only a very limited amount of people have access to capital. We happen to be a group that has huge access to capital. So no, we would invest heavily in the UK. We would be a big buyer of asset-backed sterling. You know, and so this is a public broadcast, so sort of, I want to use this phrase advisedly, but it kind of feels like making money from being a drug dealer at a school gate. I mean, it's you know, it's sensible business, but morally questionable. So, you know, I mean, so we said, well, would you then do it? The answer is yes, we will, because that's what our investors will want us to do. But it's taking advantage of what I think would be a set of unfortunate circumstances. So from M7's perspective, a hard Brexit will be a massive money-making opportunity. Would I rather that Brexit didn't happen so that the country could focus on the issues of social mobility, which is, I think, going to come to the point that our second guest is when she joins us? the what I consider to be close to an education crisis as we reach the third or fourth industrial revolution with automation and the healthcare issues that we need to deal with. I mean, there are real issues that the country faces, and Brexit masked them, and none of them are being dealt with. And I think that is a great shame.
Okay, a couple of last points before we move on, and non-Brexit points, but shared values and sheds, where much of your focus has been.
I spent 28 years waiting to be sexy.
And they have been for some time.
Well, and they've got really sexy in the last 24 months, and that's why I've now shaved my head and started going to the gym so I can catch up with sheds and be sexy in a Jason Statham kind of way. For anybody who knows me, you know that's completely untrue. But
you're looking very Jason Statham.
Thank you.
For the benefit of our listeners.
I'm really not, but I aspire.
Can that sexiness continue? Sheds, that is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, a long time ago, my boss and mentor, a guy called John Sims, and I set up a website in 1998 called lastmiledelivery.com. I mean, John was a genius in many ways. And, you know, he saw very early the opportunity around last mile delivery, which now obviously has become the key issue around what is now urban logistics, not light industrial. Light industrial is very out of vogue, urban logistics. As long as the internet and online penetration continues and more of our retailing habits go online, then the demand for sheds as part of a distribution channel is only going to continue. And the thing to remember about industrial is that everybody ascribes the huge uplift in value to online penetration and to online retailing, but all of the people who used to be there, so the Woolsey Centres, the MOT guys, they're all still there too. So those businesses are still there. So you've just got, you know, layers of demand being added and added. And of course, there's no new supply because land, whether it be for housing or for industrial, is at a premium. So yes, can sheds continue to be sexy? I think so.
And you're looking at resi as well now?
No. I was just making the point that land is, if you're talking about the green in Birmingham, we have one residential to
That's where I was thinking of, but that...
Okay, no, so
as that's going to be the entire portfolio, is it?
Of residential. So we set up a company called M7 Developments, headed by a guy called Hugh Ellingham, who is one of the greatest real estate talents I've ever met. And I wouldn't do development because I just consider it too risky unless it was with you. And we've done this one big development up in the green, and it was just a very clear money-making opportunity. And if we find more of those, we will do them as one-offs. But I like income. I like the certainty of income. I think our investors like the quarterly dividend that we provide. And I think our focus will remain on multi-let regional real estate with a bent primarily towards office and warehouse.
And lastly, the way that real estate raises money is changing as well. You yourself thought about an IPO, which you didn't pursue. There are
By the way, the best decision I have ever taken.
Why do you say that?
Well, because we bought the portfolio ourselves. So the one that we'd secured to list, so we'd sort of put it all under offer when we didn't raise the money. Well, we couldn't raise quite enough money to have an aftermarket, so we decided to buy it ourselves. So we bought it onto the balance sheet, and we sold most of it. We made a profit, which is equivalent to about 20 years worth of fees had we run it as a public company, in about 6 months. So as a trade, it was epically good. So that's why it ended up being a good decision. But we probably could have raised just enough money to limp over the line. But that, you know, that worried me in terms of what would happen to the aftermarket. And if it got off to a bad start, then you've got a moribund small REIT. That didn't seem like a good plan. And
doesn't sound like a fun role either.
No, it wouldn't have been. And then we had the opportunity to bite ourselves because we actually did raise the money. We just listed it as a bond on the International Stock Exchange and took the equity in ourselves. So we had our own equity, which we bought the portfolio. So it ended up being, like all things M7, when things go badly, and we've had a few examples where we've had issues, a bit of luck, a bit of being in the right place, right time has taken bad outcomes and made them better.
And the point I was going to make about the way that model is changing, the fundraising model that's changing, is some of the businesses that you're investing in now, like IPSX, like Jasper as well, another prop tech business that is looking to perhaps disrupt the way
we've been always a massive backer of tech. So as you know, we have another group business, but it's not a group business because it's now entirely independent, but Coyote, which was the software that we built from the ground up, led by the incredibly talented Ollie Farragher. When we set up in 2009, thought that our USP should have better information management infrastructure than anybody else. So we couldn't find the software that we needed to do that. So we built it ourselves, with Ollie leading that. And that's become an independent business, and it's fast growing. And, you know, we believe that tech's got a major role to play in property. And in fact, it's a good time to announce. We weren't going to announce it at Expo, but we're launching our first tech venture fund as well next week. So we're hiring a team to launch what's being called M7 Structura. So to take on, in a very small way, but organizations like Fifth Wall, so that, you know, we can have a UK-led prop tech venture fund.
Very interesting. How large is that?
Well, it's going to start off small, so a few tens of millions, but with a very good team, but with the M7 infrastructure behind it. And of course, we've got lots of experience ourselves, so we're an investor in a number of, so obviously you mentioned IPSX, you mentioned Jasper, we've invested in a business called Uniso. We've also, you know, M7 is a bank, or has historically provided the funding to Bank Royal Coyote. We're an experienced tech investor ourselves, and we think that's got a massive role to play in the future of real estate.
And your venture fund, this PropTech venture fund, will grow to become much more significant, do you think?
Well, we hope
within
so.
The portfolio.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like everything, we're going to start off small and see where it goes. But I mean, that's been M7's mantra, is, you know, we always do a few small things first to make sure that our thesis is correct, and do proof of concept, and then we expand from there. But certainly, one of the reasons that I've become chairman is so that I can spend a bit more time on issues like that, where I think, you know, the value of the business can be grown.
Okay, Richard, thank you. One of the things that we touched on there was how the real estate narrative is changing, whether it's sheds becoming sexy, or politics having an ever greater impact, for better or worse. But it also seems to me that the language we've used, resi, retail, offices, industrial, yields, is changing, at least to include, if not be replaced by in some senses, words like sustainability, social impact, inclusion, and well-being. And we're joined now by Alice Lamb, Deputy Chief Executive of LandAid as well. Welcome, Alice.
Hello.
Do you see that change in real estate and the partners that LandAid works with, that focus is shifting?
Absolutely. And we ran an event last week, which you kindly hosted, Damien. Thank you very much.
It was a leading question, really, wasn't it? I saw it myself
course.
That evening.
Yep. Exactly, you wanted a shout out on her. But the event was called How Can the Property Industry Be Used as a Force for Good? So it's something that we're really thinking about. Obviously, LandAid is a property industry charity, and we benefit solely from one industry, which makes us really unique. And there's a shift also from corporate social responsibility over to ESG. So we were exploring that in our panel discussion. And I think the main thing that came out of that panel discussion was that collaboration is key to creating an impact, and that's what LandAid really draws on, I think, throughout our 180 partners across the industry, and that is what sets you guys apart from other areas of business, I think.
And LandAid Day this week, engagement full and as yes. comprehensive as ever?
Yes, indeed. A busy week for us. So LandAid Day this week, the theme this year is around the world. So we've got people baking, we've got people cycling the distance from Land's End to John O'Groats. We've got a quiz at M7 all over the UK. There's things going on to raise awareness and funds for LandAid's mission to end youth homelessness, which is just amazing.
And do you see greater participation from the industry? Because I guess something like LandAid Day is indicative of how seriously it's taken some of the other factors we were talking about.
Absolutely. And we are blown away every year by the increase in participation in our events. So not only does LandAid Day happen this week, we also have the kickoff of our Steptober Challenge, kindly sponsored by M7. Thank you very much, Richard.
That's our pleasure.
Which this year sees 560 property professionals taking part, which is also mind-blowing that we've got that many people right across the UK taking on the challenge to take as many steps and raise as much money as possible in aid of our mission.
And details of how to participate in all of these things are on the website.
They are, although we are about to launch. So the sign up is now closed, but we do have walks every Wednesday, which you can find details about on our website. You don't have to be signed up Steptober to take part. It's a great networking opportunity for people across the industry to take part in our events, chat to one another, and there'll be Land Aid people there as well talking about what we do.
Thank you. And Richard, are you participating?
Well, I was going to, but when I stopped becoming chief executive, so there's a thing called the Chief Executive Challenge. I got bumped off it yesterday. So David's now taking over.
We do have David, and we have Ollie as well.
It's not too late for an executive chairman challenge,
well,
is it?
I mean, so next year, if I'm invited to. So I will be walking and a lot, mostly because I need to lose some weight, but also to contribute to one of the teams. No, I think it's a wonderful thing to be supporting. I think Land Aid is a charity that does extraordinary work, and we're incredibly proud of our association, both through Steptober, and also we have a wider association,
of course,
with Land Aid, and have had since 2016. I've just read some notes, we've raised a lot of money together, and it's certainly one of our core charity partners for the next 5 years. Is going to be our look. So we look when we do this kind of, I suppose, charitable giving. We look to find partners for the long term, because whilst you can make single donations, I think we want to make sure that charities that we work with know that they've got our support, and so that we can focus on them for the not long term. And you know, Land Aid is an extraordinary organisation that does really, really good work, and it also brings the best of the property industry out. So we're very, very proud to be associated.
And do you see the industry changing? Do you see that narrative changing?
Yeah, and you know, it needed to be honest. I mean, when I joined the industry in, hilariously, 1990, and I look in the mirror and I can't believe I'm that old, but you know, it wasn't a very sophisticated industry, to be fair. I mean, it was good fun, but it wasn't very sophisticated, and it was a bit male-centric. It was an industry that seemed to look in on itself, and it was an industry that sort of looked backwards, which wasn't very forward-looking. I think the change in real estate, in the way that we manage buildings, in the way that we manage investments, and we participate in the wider community, has definitely improved a lot over the last 20 years. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And certainly, you know, we see a lot more women in the real estate industry. You know, M7 is also part of a thing called Real Estate Balance, where we're trying to encourage greater gender equality. And there seems to be a lot more inclusiveness in the industry. I mean, I think that's true of all industries, to be fair. But I think the real estate industry is really addressing those issues. And I think that's something for the wider industry to be very proud of.
And are your investors asking for you to be different?
I want to say yes, but actually that's probably not true. We certainly ask questions about our corporate and social responsibility packages, but I think it's more because that's something that's in questionnaires. And, you know, the first thing, you know, I'm not being too unfair, but the first thing investors want to know is, are you going to make the money? But then again, if you can make the money and also have a corporate and social responsibility strategy that is generally making a difference, then yeah, and I think that's widely received.
Staff are driving it then.
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, for the generation that is coming through, you know, they expect people to be thinking about wider issues, whether it be the environment, and, you know, the way that we invest now does take into account the environment, and the way we build buildings as an industry is certainly taking account the environment, whether it be issues, you know, I mean, homelessness in a city of this wealth, it is absurd that we have homelessness, and, you know, the massive inequality of wealth is again something that needs to be addressed. But I think the industry with projects like this is doing something about that. You know, one of the things that I like enormously about Land Aid is its direct action in areas which need it the most.
Okay, thank you. And Alice, Steptober underway. One of the most closely watched parts of it is the CEO challenge.
Yeah.
Richard has been bumped, unfortunately, but who else is taking part?
I mean, I can come back if I'm invited.
Of course.
Thank you. Okay, well, I could consider myself back. I'll sort that out when I get back to the office.
I was going to say we have 12 CEOs, but now we have 13 in the mix across 13 different organisations. And so last year we had 4 CEOs take part, and that team alone raised £60,000. So you've got to beat them between the 13 of you, so no pressure. Cool. You just signed up before.
Well, it's a trebling, surely.
I shall go back and work out exactly how to crush. Is that, no, that sounds terrible, but I mean, but crush last year, so we do much better.
Mm. Yes, please. So, yeah, as I said, we've got David from M7 and also Ollie from Coyote signed up and a few others that I can't remember off the top of my head.
But give us some names, just so I know who I'm phoning to.
You've got Colin Wilson, and then you've got Bill Hughes.
Okay.
Rob Bold, of course, is taking part. He's not allowed.
Now.
Yeah, he's not allowed not to.
So we'll chase him, and then if we chase each other, maybe we'll just get a few more steps in.
Yeah. So I can't remember anymore, I'm afraid.
Okay, that's a very good group.
I can send you a list, but so that gives it a real exclusivity, which is amazing for this year. And also, we have 560 general participants taking part. But I think the feedback from this is the second year it's ever happened, so it's our second Steptober Challenge. The first year we had 500 people take part, so we've increased on that. But the feedback from last year was how fun, inclusive, accessible the challenge was. So it was people all throughout the business who were taking on the steps very seriously, but also the fundraising. So last year we had people calling up saying that they had treadmills installed at their desks, they had walking meetings, and also people ringing up accusing other people of cheating on the step numbers. So we like them to take it extremely seriously and get really competitive, which is what the property industry is good at, I think.
To very constructive effect there. Okay, I'm afraid we'll have to wrap it up there, but Alice, thank you very much, and
thank
Richard,
you.
Thank you to you too.
My pleasure.